You're listening to Strictly Business Podcast with Lindsay Williams.
It's 2020, of course, so it's time for the first It's My Money of the new year. And unfortunately, Magnus Haystack Sr. from Brentos Wealth, it's not the greatest start to the new year because just out, and you alerted me to this on FIN24, that was around about 11 o'clock South African time this morning, it says here, shock, World Bank cuts SA growth forecast to below 1% due to load shedding. And I think we're in phase two at the moment. But anyway, it's a familiar story.
Yes, good day, Lindsay, and a great year for you and the listeners to this show of yours.
Thank you.
I think the World Bank is just confirming what we all suspect. I mean, you cannot have economic growth when your electricity supplier cannot supply reliable power, and the fact that we had load shedding over the Christmas period leading up to Christmas for the retailers, which was bad enough. And then when the factories are all closed, so it does indicate that the problems at Eskom are probably substantially bigger than we are led to believe. So you don't need to be too smart to work out. It's going to be a very tough year in terms of the economy, especially manufacturing, farming, retailing, and possibly even mining. Although mining is benefiting from very nicely rising prices, but on a production level, it's going to be very tough. So, yeah, just brace yourself. It's not going to be fun. There's all kinds of rumors going around that, you know, we could be living almost semi-permanently with stage 2 to 6 load shedding for a very, very long time, and then you're not going to have much growth.
No, and the thing is that we need investment into Eskom, short, medium, and long term. We need a short term fix to keep the lights on, and some people are suggesting that it should be permanent stage one load shedding in order to relieve the burden. I don't know the technicalities of that, but that's what some people are saying. But it seems to me that we need money to keep the lights on, but that money is not forthcoming, and so it's almost like a catch-22 situation we have here.
You know, it might seem a stupid statement to make that we must have permanent stage 2 load shedding, but it will then allow manufacturers and industrialists and even business people to plan, to know that in advance that's when the power is off and that's when the power is on. And human beings, what they are, they can work around it, but it's the unpredictability and the unreliability of the power supply that affects business confidence, consumer spending, and everything that you do with power. So it might not be such a bad idea after all. So let's have permanent stage 2 load shedding and use that period to fix the system. Otherwise, it can go to 4 and 6 very, very quickly. And that's when you get the body blows to business confidence and consumer confidence.
Yes, you're quite right. I've always had this argument with people, and I've said it doesn't matter whether, for example, I'll use the Rand as an example here. It doesn't matter whether the Rand is 10 to the US dollar or 20 to the US dollar. As long as people know that it's 20 to the US dollar and there is stability rather than massive volatility, then that's fine, because you can plan forward if you know that the Rand is at this level. And the same, I suppose, is what you've just said with the load shedding situation. You know exactly how much you can use and when you can use it, so you can make provision for it. But if there's uncertainty, that's what stuffs us up.
That's correct. You know, and in the area that I live in, you know, you speak to the small retailers, shop owners, restaurant owners, and hairdressers and stuff. Not that I see a hairdresser that often anymore.
I was going to say, you know, that, yeah.
I just go to pay my wife's bill. That's all I do. But, you know, they say to you, how do I plan? I have a full morning's worth of bookings. I can see 10 clients in that period of time, and whoops, overnight it's gone. And then you lose those clients and the turnover and the profits for life. So I think what's going to happen in the next month or two, we will see the from a tax revenue collection, we will see the full impact of the load shedding during the Christmas period, because that was peak selling time for retailers, and that has just knocked tax collection very badly. And we're going to see the numbers. I think it's going to, again, shock and amaze us quite dramatically.
Yes, indeed. In fact, they've got the same situation. We're not alone in this regard, because in the United Kingdom, they've had the worst retail year in recorded history. But anyway, let's not talk about retail too much now. The PMI came out yesterday while we're on the macroeconomic theme at 47.7, mired below 50. And then again, that is just a reflection of lack of demand and also lack of supply when it comes to electricity, Magnus.
Well, it's also confidence, you know, just again, you know, referring to my own personal situation, I, at one stage in the last 3 or 4 weeks, I was contemplating maybe trading in my 7-year-old Range Rover, which was giving me no problems, maybe upgrade, you know, for the, and then you sit down and you say, no, I don't want to do that. I'd rather keep my cash spare and deploy it somewhere else. That is what confidence does. It changes your thinking about the future, and human beings being what they are, they pull back and say, no, I need to conserve my cash because I don't know what could happen a year or two down the line. So, and you see that in car sales. Car sales are under tremendous pressure. People are driving their cars for longer.
Yes.
And also postponing new purchases. So that, I think, is very evident in the economy.
Yeah, one of the reasons that people are doing that is because of confidence, the confidence factor that you've just alluded to, but also because cars just last longer these days. I mean, you can drive a car into the ground. Instead of having it for 2 years and it would break down and you have to get a new one, you can drive it for 10 years and it's still serviceable. It may not be fashionable, but it's still serviceable. You were speaking about deploying your cash. Now, what are you going to do for 2020? Because this is a look forward to 2020 through the eyes of Brenthurst Wealth and yourself. What are you saying? Same as 2019?
You know, it's again a question of where do we see value? You looking at a range of indicators, macro versus micro, and we still see extremely low value in the local market, especially the domestic JSE. We see very little, and we think that even at the fairly depressed levels, the JSE is still expensive in terms of future earnings. So I think there could still be a downward adjustment or a sideways movement for a very long period of time. So we're very negative domestic equities. We kind of like cash and bonds. That's very attractive. And also extremely negative on the local listed property market. You know, we have no exposure to the listed property market and still don't see any reason to increase it. Offshore, again, you know, after last year's stellar year, I mean, you need to be a little bit worried about valuations. And now maybe is the time to be considering alternative strategies, maybe cash and maybe defensive sectors like energy, like oil, and maybe a little bit of gold. Gold and platinum have done very well. So you need to monitor these things on an ongoing basis. But to summarize your question, underweight SA equities, neutral bonds and cash, and still overweight global equities, bearing in mind we're not going to see another 30% a year. We will be very happy with 10% in dollar terms. So that still remains our kind of a overall market approach.
You've been very vocal on Twitter and other platforms as well about South Africa, and I noticed a tweet this morning saying that cash has outperformed yet again. But do you advocate people going into cash and bonds or fixed income rather than equities? What would your ideal asset allocation? For example, if I won the lottery and I came to you with a couple of million rand, what would you say to me? You'd sit me down and give me a pie chart and say, you've got to do this, 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 and this. Just give me a rough idea of the strategy you would employ for me.
Well, I look at many factors first of all, and I'll try and ask you the question: where do you want to be in 10 years' time? Where do you see yourself living, your kids? And that is today in South Africa, increasingly a factor when people walk through the door. You have to ask them the question. You cannot assume that they will be retiring in South Africa in 10 or 15 years from now, because their kids have left the country. They probably will join their kids in New Zealand or in the States or in Holland, wherever they end up. Once you answer those questions, then you say, right, if you are going to end up, or there's a possibility of you ending up overseas, let's increase your offshore exposure to protect yourself against currency movements and other things like that. Then you start building assets overseas. If someone says to you, listen, I'm a stayer. I'm going to stay in South Africa. Now, I'm not interested. Then you can change that allocation a bit and say, look, we can give you a very, very nice income from the high bond yields and the high income funds, 9 to 10%. And that's it. And a smaller portion to the offshore, markets. But it depends on a lot of factors. But generally, most people in South Africa, if you look at the total asset base, the overall wealth situation, hopelessly overexposed to residential property, which has been a very bad investment. Secondly, they mostly, the pension funds are exposed to the local market, and they have very little offshore exposure. So we're still doing the adjustment of getting more offshore exposure to a lesser or a greater degree, depending on circumstances. Because right now, you know, I tongue-in-cheek tweaked about retirement shedding. If you look at residential property, you made no money in 10 years in South Africa. Mm-hmm. Your JSC has given you extreme low returns. So if you look at your 10-year projections 10 years ago and compare them with what they eventually turned out to be, you are 30% under your target. So a lot of people are the baby boomers, the guys retiring in the next 5 to 10 years, are 30% behind target, if I can put it that way. They are, to the astonishment, finding out, wow, I'm not even close to what I thought I would be, because my assumptions were all incorrect.
You talk about a group of people called the stayers, and well done to the stayers, because they may be right. They may be taking a contrarian view, and they may be right in 3 to 5 years' time. Who knows? Let's hope they will be. But on the other hand, you must sit them down and say, just in case things blow up, just in case we have to go with our begging bowl to the IMF, just in case we have to go there and the rand blows out to 20, 25, 30 to the US dollar, you have to have a hedge against that. Even if you're a stayer, there has to be some sort of mitigating part of your portfolio just in case South Africa doesn't do as well as you're expecting it to do.
Of course you have to. I mean, you know, I look at my situation, all my kids are in South Africa, all my grandkids are in South Africa. I do not want to leave the country, but most of my liquid investments have been overseas for 10 years because I consider myself to be a global citizen and a global consumer. My consumption expenditure, if I analyze it, is medical aid, technology, overseas travel, overseas hotels, and my mountain bikes are made in Taiwan and not in South Africa. So you have to invest in dollars because you're going to pay in dollars at one stage. And I think South Africans are now starting to work it out. Whether they're going or staying, it doesn't make a difference. They do spend a lot of money on overseas products. If I can take medical aid, for instance, we all know at what rate medical aid fees are rising. And that's imported directly from the United States, where you pay for technology, for skills. And if you're going to invest in rand to pay in dollars in 10 years from now, you're not going to afford it. So it's a fairly logical argument. So I would like to stay in South Africa for the rest of my life, but I do not want to be in a position where if it does fall apart, that I am a refugee going back to Holland and saying, okay, I'm back.
Yes. So you don't want to be held hostage by things that you can't control.
I want to be helpless. I want to be in control of it, and that's a very mature approach to your little role in the greater scheme of things. But to be continuously told everything will come right, and it's not coming right in many respects. I just don't want to be in that position.
Are you seeing any hope for the stayers? Are you seeing any sort of lights at end of tunnels or green shoots?
You know, Lindsay, if you travel through the Western Cape, if you travel from Cape Town to Stellenbosch, and then you go to Franschhoek, and you go to Paarl, and you go to Swellendam and those parts, George, Mossel Bay, you think you're in a different country. The towns are clean. The roads are paved. There is an efficient administration at the municipalities. So the Western Cape is, if you do want to move within the boundaries of South Africa, the Western Cape is where they are making it happen, and it works. I mean, I kid you not, I got a letter from a municipality in the Paarl He says, "Dear sir, we owe you some money. Please provide your banking details." So, no. You know, that blew me. It blew me away. I made an overpayment 6 months ago, and they picked it up, and they said, "Can we pay you back?" So the Western Cape is working, and there are parts in the country that the stayers are saying, let's make it work. But you cannot do that without support from the government and the local authorities, because that's where our problem lies. There was a tweet this morning by Helen Ziller about they are fixing all the potholes in Kimberley for the ANC meeting today and tomorrow. And I just tweeted back and I said, don't fix that big hole, because that's not a pothole.
Yes, you see, you don't make yourself very popular, Magnus, do you, with that sort of thing? But you know, you're absolutely right.
You know, I'm too old to be worried about that. I just feel that, and to be very serious, if it's the role of a financial advisor, I think honesty and being true to the facts is very important. It's like you going to your doctor. And the doctor knows what the facts are, and he rather spins you a wonderful story and things will be fine. Don't worry. You can smoke 20 packets a day and 6 beers a day and you'll be fine. It's just the facts are what they are. I cannot change the facts. And if the facts change, I'll be the first one to say it. And, it's not that I'm negative. I'm a very positive person, but the facts tell me if I want to build wealth, considering what South Africa is going through, it has to be somewhere else. And I don't like saying it, but that is the truth, is it not?
No, it really is the truth. Magnus, thank you so much for your analysis and your brutal honesty, as always. That's Magnus Haystack Sr., who is from Brenthurst Wealth, sometimes in Johannesburg. The views and opinions expressed in these podcasts are those of Lindsay Williams and various contributors and do not reflect the policy, position, or opinion of any other agency, organization, employer, or company associated with strictlybusinesspodcast.com. Assumptions made on the analyses are not reflective of the position of any other entity other than the speaker or the author. And since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to change, revision, and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity.